WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this month at the New Yorker Festival, our weekend-long bonanza of interviews and live events of all kinds, Sally Yates sat down with the legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. Yates is a former deputy attorney general, and she served under Republican and Democratic presidents. But now she's emerged as a prominent critic of the Trump administration. And her name is being whispered as a possible candidate for high office. Now, that's a possibility she usually downplays, but she hasn't shut it down entirely. Here's Jeffrey Toobin, a staff writer at The New Yorker, with Sally Yates.
Sally was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. She went to the University of Georgia. She went to the University of Georgia Law School. And in 1989, she became an assistant U.S. attorney in the city of Atlanta. She prosecuted a lot of big cases, including Eric Rudolph, who was the white supremacist who bombed the 1986 Olympics. And in 2010, President Obama appointed Sally the U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Georgia, which is Atlanta. And in 2015, she was confirmed as Deputy Attorney General of the United States. On January 20th, 2017, briefly but eventfully, she became the Attorney General of the United States, and that's where our story is going to start. January 20th, 2017, where were you? What happened?
Well, I was serving as Deputy Attorney General, and there is a tradition at the Department of Justice that in the transition time in administrations, the Deputy Attorney General of the prior administration serves as the acting AG for the incoming administration. To maintain continuity, you know, it's important in any agency, particularly DOJ, but there's another tradition as well.
Which is?
Nothing happens during that time. My chief of staff told me I would have nothing to do, so there would be plenty of time for, in her words, long boozy lunches.
On January 24th, 4 days later, Michael Flynn, the incoming national security advisor, was interviewed by the FBI. The next day, the 25th, the FBI came to you.
God, this seems like a lifetime ago.
I know. It's ancient history, but trust me, it's interesting.
Okay. Well, an issue had arisen with respect to sanctions that President Obama had imposed and that actually had strong bipartisan support, sanctions against the Russians based on their interference in our election. And it was very strange that despite the imposition of these sanctions, the Russians didn't do anything in response. And so the intel community was trying to figure that out. And in the course of that, discovered that Mike Flynn, who was going to be the incoming National Security Advisor, had been having discussions with Mr. Kislyak, who was the Russian ambassador, essentially imploring him not to do anything in response to those sanctions. But then the situation got a lot worse because people in the administration, starting with Sean Spicer and others, and ultimately culminating in Vice President Pence, went out and were telling the American people that there had been no such discussions. We knew, because we had recordings of these conversations, that we weren't the only ones who knew that General Flynn was providing false information ostensibly to people in the administration who were then providing false information to the American people. We weren't the only ones who knew that. The Russians knew that too. And because this had become such a big public thing, this is precisely the kind of information they would love to be able to hold over the head of the National Security Advisor, which made him potentially compromised.
Compromised. It's a blackmail. So what did you do? What happened next?
So I contacted Don McGahn, who
the White House counsel,
and told him that I needed to come see him right away, told him what we had learned, that, you know, the vice president had been on Face the Nation and is saying, you know, I've talked to General Flynn personally, and he has assured me that there were no conversations about sanctions. So you got the VP out there saying this stuff. So we told Mr. McGahn how we knew that it wasn't true, how we happened to have recordings of these conversations, and why we thought it was a problem.
And you go see him a second time on January 27th?
Yeah, he asked me to come back.
Was that different or the same, or what was?
It was a little different in the sense that he was a bit more combative, I guess I would say, in this discussion. And, you know, I've testified before that sort of one of his first questions was, what's it to the Department of Justice if one White House official lies to another?
And what did you make of that?
Well, I tried to explain to him that it was a whole lot more than just one White House official lying to another, which, God, I would hope he would be concerned about anyway, but that it was more than that, that the underlying conduct here, that General Flynn having these discussions to begin with is problematic, but beyond that, again, it's the issue of compromise, that the Russians know this, it provides potential leverage, and this is a problem. And we also thought, you know, that Vice President Pence was entitled to know that the stuff that he was saying when he stood, you know, in front of the public, that wasn't true. So we were trying to help them.
So your second meeting with Don McGahn is January 27th. Yeah. Also on January 27th, an executive order is issued.
Yeah.
Banning travel from seven Muslim-majority countries. Did you know anything about that until it was issued?
No, and that's the remarkable thing. I'm sitting right there in Don McGahn's office talking to him at length, and he doesn't tell me that the president at this point has already signed an executive order, as you said, banning immigration from these countries, and that the Department of Justice is going to have to be in court the very next morning defending this.
So how did you find out about the travel ban?
I was in the car. I was literally in the car on the way to the airport, and I get a call. I was able to keep one aide with me, one assistant, my principal deputy, the top deputy, the whole time. And so Matt calls me, and he says, after you left, you know, I went online. I was reading the New York Times, and it looks like President Trump has issued some sort of travel ban. We spent the weekend trying to get our arms around and communicating with the White House of what is it that you're trying to do. And by Monday morning, I was told that we would have to take a position on the constitutionality of the travel ban the next morning in a case. So we convened everybody in my conference room and spent a very long time in there talking through what the challenges were, what the White House position was in terms of the scope of the travel ban. We talked about the different challenges, both constitutionally and statutorily and otherwise, that had been filed. And at the end of that conversation, I was not satisfied that it was lawful or constitutional. And what troubled me beyond that was that it became eminently clear that to defend the constitutionality of this, I was going to have to send Department of Justice lawyers in to take the position that this travel ban that applied just to Muslim-majority countries had absolutely nothing to do with religion. And this was in the face of all of the president's statements that he had made, both on the campaign trail and after he had been elected. And that did not seem like the truth to me.
But isn't it usually the job of the Department of Justice to defend actions of the administration, even if you personally would not have done, you know, issued that order, or I mean, you're the president, you're the executive branch's lawyers.
Right.
So why wasn't that good enough for you to say, I'm going to defend this?
Well, it wasn't just that I disagreed with this on a policy ground. Perhaps the appropriate thing then to do would be to resign if you can't be part of that, but not direct the department, not to defend it. But here's what's different, is that I happen to believe no litigant should go into court and make an argument that's not grounded in truth. But the Department of Justice, I mean, if DOJ stands for anything, it's supposed to stand for what is true and what is just.
So what did you do?
I knew that I personally couldn't be part of defending this and arguing something that wasn't grounded in truth. But, you know, I thought about, well, maybe the thing to do is resign. And that would have protected my personal integrity. I wouldn't have been part of this. But I wasn't like just the head of the civil division or, you know, some other component of the department. I was the acting attorney general of the United States, and I felt like I had a responsibility to protect not just my personal integrity, but the integrity of the Department of Justice as well. And I thought back to my confirmation hearing when there were some senators, including Senator Sessions, who they were all over me at my confirmation hearing about what I would do if the president asked me to do something that was unlawful or wrong. And I think Senator Sessions said, you know, even if it's just something that would bring disrepute to the Department of Justice, you know, you're going to be asked to do that, and will you say no? You know, none of them were asking me, will you resign? They were asking me, will you say no? And they were right about that. It wasn't my responsibility in that position, I think, to resign. I think it was my responsibility to say no.
So how did you say no? It wasn't like a public statement, it was just a communication?
No, we had both. There were communications going on at levels below me and between me and Mr. McGann, and I issued the directive to the department.
And then what happened?
I was fired.
You were fired by Donald Trump before it was fashionable to be fired by Donald Trump. Did that surprise you, or how did you think this story was going to end once you said you weren't going to allow the travel ban to be defended?
Look, I certainly recognize there was a very real possibility, I would say probability, that I would be fired in this context. But I hoped that maybe there was a chance that by doing this, that would cause them to step back and take a breath and look at what they were doing. And more, okay, I know.
Everybody's
all right, so you guys
laughing.
Think I was, no. Yeah.
It's impolite to laugh at the former Attorney General of the United States.
It seems kind of silly now, doesn't it? But, you know, I did harbor this hope that maybe they would step back. They would have the kind of process. They would get the kind of input. There would be real discussion about this. I had spent 27 years at the Department of Justice. I loved that place. I did not want to have the period on my service there being fired.
What's your assessment of the whole series of events?
I suppose you could say that the president had made a campaign promise, and he was making good on that promise. But beyond the fact that I believe that particularly the first one was unlawful and unconstitutional, I think it's absolutely the antithesis of who we are as a country. And
we're listening to Sally Yates, a longtime Justice Department official who was the acting attorney general at the start of the Trump administration. Sally Yates spoke with Jeffrey Toobin at the New Yorker Festival.
Now, as you mentioned, the travel ban was revised once. Mm-hmm. It was revised twice. The courts had struck down each of the versions, including the third and final version, until it went to the Supreme Court, which upheld it 5-4. Mm-hmm. What's your view of the travel ban in its final form and of the Supreme Court's decision about it?
You know, I haven't studied Travel Ban 3 the same way that I did the first one. You know, I still, despite the other revisions of, you know, taking out the preference for Christians and throwing in a couple of, you know, non-Muslim majority countries, despite the fact that, you know, they made some changes, you know, I am still troubled by the animus that I believe infected the first as well as the final travel ban.
And we've had this paradoxical situation since Jeff Sessions has been Attorney General, where he has been, in the policy areas you talk about, very much advancing the Trump agenda. At the same time, the president has been just beating the hell out of him in public. What do you make of that? I mean, what do you make of that?
What's up with that?
Yeah, what's up with that? Thank you.
You know, I mean, I think he clearly has been trying to humiliate him into resigning. I mean, that, you know, that's been going on for so long now, it like doesn't even make the news anymore. But when it became clear, I think, that Attorney General Sessions was not going to resign, now he seems determined to undermine the legitimacy of the department and the FBI and anybody else who is involved with the Russia probe, I believe, to delegitimize any findings from that probe. It's certainly elevating himself and being willing to tear down critical democratic institutions for self-protection.
What about the role of Rod Rosenstein? Rod Rosenstein definitely has raised the profile of deputy attorney generals. You thought you were famous. Rod Rosenstein is maybe the most famous lawyer in America. He is, because Attorney General Sessions is recused, he is the supervisor of the Mueller investigation. Yeah. How do you think Rosenstein has handled that?
I think he's done a really good job of that. I think, you know,
you've known Rosenstein?
Oh, yeah, I knew him back when we were U.S. attorneys together in the Obama administration, and so I've known Rod for a long time. And look, I know everybody for a while was so focused on making sure that we protect Robert Mueller. And goodness knows, I think we need to protect Bob Mueller. But it's equally as important to protect Rod Rosenstein right now because he really has control over what ultimately happens in this investigation.
I mean, in fact, the report that Mueller writes doesn't go to Congress. It goes to his supervisor, who is the deputy attorney general. So you could have a deputy attorney general who receives the report and says, thank you very much, puts it in a drawer, and that's the end of the story.
And that certainly seems to be the course that our president would think that that person should take.
Well, it does seem like, I mean, the president has all but written on a wall that he's going to fire the attorney general after the midterms. Do you think he's going to fire Rosenstein too?
You know, far be it from me to get in Donald Trump's head.
Yeah.
You know, he's walked them both up to the guillotine multiple times now, only to then pull back. So it's hard to know if it's one or the other, or he does it in a swoop, or neither, and he just continues to torture them. It's kind of hard to know. It's whatever I think he thinks will be best for him.
The president appoints the attorney general. Is he the president's lawyer? Is he the people's lawyer? What is the role and what's the relationship? What should it be? Because it's not a simple thing.
No, and I get that a lot of people might look and say, look, the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch, just like the Department of Agriculture or Commerce or any of the other agencies, and you answer to the president, you're the president's lawyer. That is so not true. And I remember, actually, when I first became U.S. attorney, and we all went to the White House for what was essentially a photo op with Eric Holder, attorney general then. And, you know, we're all lined up in the bleachers in the East Room there for the president to come in. And you know, he comes in and he looked at us there and said, look, I have appointed each and every one of you, and I know you're going to do a great job, but there's only one thing you need to remember, and that is you don't represent me. You represent the people of the United States. And as long as you remember that, you're going to do your job and everything's going to be okay.
So, it's so 2009.
Yeah.
Let me read you a tweet from President Trump, which relates a little to the criminal justice dimension. Very sad that the FBI missed all the many signals sent out by the Florida school shooter. This was the Parkland shooting, the high school. This is not acceptable. They are spending too much time trying to prove Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. There is no collusion. Get back to the basics and make us all proud. I know you're...
it's just...
You can't be at a loss for word. It's the New Yorker Festival.
Okay. Sickening. I mean, he's taking a tragedy where children were killed, and he is using that tragedy to attack an investigation of his own campaign.
What effect do you think this, the kind of criticism of DOJ, the criticism of the FBI, has day to day?
Well, let me say what effect I don't think it has first.
Okay.
I don't think it impacts the substantive decisions that are being made by the line prosecutors and the line agents there. Folks having confidence in DOJ and the FBI, that has real life consequences.
When
agents go knocking on doors to try to find witnesses or others to provide information in cases, when you are sowing that kind of distrust, that has a real impact on public safety. When juries are sitting in trials and are hearing testimony from FBI agents, and they're thinking about what their president has said about how, you know, they're liars and all, you know, part of a deep state trying to undermine this administration, that can't help but have an impact there. And I think that, you know, the public's confidence in our criminal justice system is essential for that system to be able to work. And that, to me, is one of the great tragedies of all of this, is how that's being abused. One of the things I really worry about is, where are we when this administration is over? I mean, what's the new normal at that point? What have we so debased, not just public discourse, but the dignity of the presidency and Congress and the Department of Justice and others, that we look and are entirely different than we were before? How's that for a
down? Oh,
God. I'm sorry, God. That is, yeah. God, I depressed myself with that.
You are now a partner at King & Spalding, big firm. And a lot of people want you to run for office. Is that going to happen?
No, well, that's it.
I knew I'd get that reaction. I pander with the best of them, yes.
Now, you know, when people have mentioned that, I'm incredibly flattered. Doesn't even feel like the right word there. I mean, it means a lot to me that people have said that they would like me to do that or would trust me to do that. Public service, absolutely. I mean, that's in my heart, and I believe in that. Running for office just feels very different to me than that. I just have a hard time seeing running.
But if a different president wanted to call you back to Washington, wouldn't be out of the question for you to go?
I believe in public service.
There we go. All right. Please join me in thanking Grace Salier.
Thanks, everybody.
Sally Yates, former Deputy Attorney General, and briefly, ever so briefly, the acting attorney general, speaking with Jeffrey Toobin at the New Yorker Festival earlier this month.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.